Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Malcolm Garvey, here we study. Malcolm Garvey, here we. Their life was like a movie study. Malcolm Garvey, here we. Malcolm Garvey, here we. Malcolm Garvey, here we. Their life was like a movie study. I die, I organize. Everything I do's revolutionize. I build what's good for the whole damn hood. Study G's like these, really think you should. I study Malcolm Garvey, here we. Malcolm Garvey, Huey, Marcel Cody with the Uzi, listening to Fela Kuti. I'm a goon with the machete, especially if it's deli. Got the Santos for the Hexy to protect me, so respect me. This is heavy, legendary, revolutionary. My wifey, she resurrect me when they thought they had me buried. Took me out the cemetery, now it's family over every. Cause it's all that's necessary to avoid the commissary. I'ma live for you five, so I stop getting high. If you know, then you recognize. It's that black and brown pride, it's the power of the mind. RBG, God divine, you can see through the lies if you can read between the lines. I live, I die, I
organized. Everything I do revolutionized. I build what's good for the whole damn hood. Study G's like these really get you should.
Study
Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey.
Malcolm Garvey Huey. Bungie Bobby Pockin' Tookie. Sitting by the door so you can say I'm acting spooky. Just like in the movie, son, you better pack your toolie. Niggas switch be acting fruity, you'll be cracking like they pookie. Rather smoke a doobie than be burning and eluding. Bang, bang, pig shooting, we should blame Rudy Julie. Yanny for the camera, shine a white and nose candy. Let you banging on the system, you a gangster wearing panties. RBG my family from the Bronx to Miami. Police cannot stand me, Pacquiao like a Manny. Call me little Bobby Hutton, cause I'm first to push the button. Rappers don't be saying nothing to the system, we say fuck em. This is for Nahanda, mama C, mama Akua. All the real OGs, I'm a soldier, cause you told me study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey, I'm reporting in the duty.
Sticky icky, yours truly here for duty. Don DeVino, M.A. Uno, you know how we drop the jury. This is real, not a movie, not Mickey Donald Goofy. I'm a soldier, I avoid a bitch nigga like the cootie.
School face in a hoodie.
Fresh pair of khakis, we can do this like we fam. I go to war like the Apache for whatever. I stay ready, I learned that in Tallahassee. Robert Toon, they used to school me as a juvie. Skipping classes, never let the system use me. My duty is my passage. Watch the homies in your army, they don't always show they badges. Keep your family living healthy, teach your children about their blackness. Teach your wifey how to use the ratchet. This shit is classic, get your food, clothes, and shelter. Fuck the system, pimp it backwards. I ain't hating, I'm just saying. If you wanna be a rapper, study
Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey.
A tactical approach is designed to get certain results. It's designed to keep you alive. It's designed to bring about victory.
Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. Of somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will pop. Yes, I'm black. I'm proud of it. I'm black and beautiful.
Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. They gave leadership to our foreparents and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars have passed through the colleges and universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards. You race of imbeciles, you race of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die. Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it. We have prayed to God for vision and for leadership. And he has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies, but a vision that said it must be a free and redeemed Africa. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised. We appeal to you for help, for succor, for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden up the heights of Calvary, when white men spurned you, when white men scorned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side out of which blood and water gushed forth, it was a black man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took your cross and bore it up the heights of Calvary. And now that we are bearing our burden of being so heavy, we just ask that you just help us on up the heights. Oh yes, the cause is grand, the cause is glorious. Surely we shall not turn back. Oh, sail on, sail on, sail on. Oh, mighty ship of state, sail on. Sail on until the flag of the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hills of their Africa. Because the time has come for a black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own. We must canonize our own saints, create our own martyrs, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history.
Ah, yes. Marcus, giving us our orders. Welcome to Keep It On News. Once again, I'm your combat reporter, Brother Tuckmill Sankara. We're streaming to you live on New Black Panther Party Radio, YouTube, Facebook, getting this social media thing together here. But Marcus is speaking in the tone of nationhood here as we go into our Kwanzaa season, collective work and responsibility. This is the crux of the teachings of Marcus Garvey, to understand how to become a nation and how to put that collective work and responsibility together. And so to understand Comrade Marcus and the example that he gave to us, what I wanted to do this evening was, first of all, give us from this volume here, Marcus Garvey Hero by Tony Hill. It is in a series of books, understanding in the path of organizational work, one must continue to hone one's historical knowledge and organizational historical experience and to understand that so that we know that where we're going in today's morass of pandemic genocide. And in this collection by Tony, all praise due to the ancestor, there are 9 volumes here, and I just want to read them off to you. There's 1, Literary Garveyism, Garvey, Black Arts in the Harlem Renaissance. And then there's the poetical works of Marcus Garvey, you know, these songs and poems that Marcus Garvey has produced. 3, Marcus Garvey Hero, a first biography, that this volume. 4, Amy Ashwell Garvey, Pan-Africanist, Feminist, and Wife, 1. 5, African Fundamentalism, a literary anthology of the Garvey movement. At this time when this volume was written, that wasn't out. It says forthcoming, but that is out now. 6, The Pan-African Connection, From Slavery to Garvey and Beyond. Sounds interesting. 7, A Message to the People, The Course of African Philosophy, by Marcus Garvey, edited by Tony Martin. So Marcus is giving us a course of African philosophy there. You check that out. 8, Race First, the Ideological and Organizational Struggles of Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. That's the one right there. That got all the stuff from the course and who snitched and all of that. 9, The Philosophy of the Opinions of Marcus Garvey. Of course, we know what you mean. Really a kind of continuation of that. Those last 2 volumes really can be studied together. But out of this volume, I'd like to start with, as I said, to just highlight certain points in regards to 1, Marcus Garvey's life, and then 2, occurrences within the organization that may not be as highly publicized and known in our African historical circles, because Tony is the man. He is the scholar on Marcus. He has those volumes and more. But an interesting thing I was reading about Marcus Garvey's early life and of those around him and where he had come from, and Dr. John Henry Clark often spoke of these Africans who had from Jamaica and from the West Indies already laid that path of Pan-Africanism that Garvey was able to learn from, come out of, and ultimately take it to its zenith. So it says here, a fair number of Afro-West Indians of the late 19th century had been born in Africa. Many more would have parents and grandparents born there, and with the freedom that came with emancipation had come also a freedom to express their deep interest in their African motherland. Mandingos from Trinidad had to be sent back home to West Africa, and at least one succeeded in making it back to Gambia. In the 1850s, churchmen from Codrington College in Barbados established a mission in the Rio Congo area of what is now Guinea. In that same decade, Edward Wilmot Blyton immigrated from St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands to Liberia via the United States. In time, he became one of the greatest and of 19th century African scholars and statesmen, and was the favorite author of the young Marcus Garvey. So you see that root coming out of that which had already occurred with Edward Wilmot Blyton. You also had others. I'm not sure if they were mentioned here, but Bishop Henry McNeil Turner. They're talking about West Indians here. And I think Bishop Henry McNeil Turner was too, but I know Martin Delaney came from, he was that diaspora African born in the United States. And he also had immigrated to Africa. Often called that father of Pan-Africanism, military officer Martin Delaney. So these are some of the figures that were Blyton that were the predecessors to Garvey out of the West Indies. It says here, in 1865, 346 Barbadians immigrated to Liberia, partly due to the influence of Blyton. One of them, Arthur Barclay, eventually became president of Liberia from 1904 to 1912. His son, Edwin, served as Secretary of State and acting president. Around 1900, several thousand Cubans were trying to return to their homes in the Belgian Congo. Some succeeded. Many more West Indians not only returned to Africa, but did what little they could to speak out on Africa's behalf, especially during the conquest of most of Africa by Europe, which took place after 1860. Among these was H. Sylvester Williams, a Trinidadian lawyer who organized the Pan-African Conference in London in 1900. I know those of us who listen to Dr. Clark here have heard these names, H. Sylvester Williams. Here, West Indians, Africans, and Afro-Americans examined the problem facing peoples of African origin all over the world and petitioned Queen Victoria of England to improve the conditions facing Africans in South Africa. Right? So that work, we're talking about 1860. We're talking about before the Berlin Conference, before they got themselves organized to split it up. Right? Of course, things were already happening. Slavery was already going on, of course. But the organized effort of the whole of Europe had not even been taking place yet during this time when Blyton, so Blyton was able to get, how many did he say? 346? Barbadians? 346. That's significant. You know what I mean? That's like real Pan-African, real Pan-Africanism, repatriation. It was with Blyton. Shout out to the ancestors. But so Garvey coming up in Jamaica, of course, it speaks of, the condition of the time period where Garvey came up. Of course, born August 17, 1887, at St. Anne's Bay in the parish of St. Anne on Jamaica's north coast. He was the last of 11 children, all of whom died in childhood except for a sister, Indiana. His parents were Marcus and Sarah Garvey, and the family was reasonably comfortable compared with the average peasant of that time. Mr. Garvey was a stonemason by trade. He read widely, was consequently well-informed and a respected figure in the community. He was stern and withdrawn and never developed a close relationship with his son. He was said to be a descendant of Jamaica's Maroons, the well-known African slaves who escaped to the hills and forced the British to recognize their virtual independence, even during the days of slavery. Miss Garvey was quite unlike her husband. Marcus once described her as a sober and conscientious Christian, too soft and good for the time in which she lived. Marcus loved St. Anne's Day. Years later, he would write, "I was born in the beautiful parish of St. Anne near the falls of the Roaring River. I grew with nature and drank much of her inspiration. His boyhood days were active and full of varied experiences. He was a strong boy and well-liked by his playmates, who looked up to him somewhat of a leader." And then it goes into, we know the thing about the white friends that Garvey had, and when he came to understand that there was something different about him, that they no longer held him in the same light. So do we go into the period of time where the trade takes place? And this is very significant when you talk about Marcus Garvey. And I feel like I have a very specific lens into that because I went to a vocational high school and studied cabinet making and millwork. Garvey was a printer by trade. As a matter of fact, my best friend in high school, D. Jackson, shout out D. Jackson, Tampa, Florida, was in the shop next to me, and he was in the printing trade. Today, that's what he does. Just graphic arts, right? Today, what I do, I'm a carpenter, right? So Garvey understood something, and the understanding of that is something that we have to get back into now, because no one is. If you're going to build a nation, it's like, okay, we have to understand some things on the intellectual level, but more importantly, vocational and technical skills are going to help you more, right? And so that's what the situation was. You know the argument, liberal arts and W.B. Du Bois versus vocational arts with Booker T. and Malcolm Garvey. But what I need you to understand about the fact that he went into that trade specifically in his life and the places it took him, right? Of course, being a timekeeper on some of the Central American plantations there, you being a timekeeper. They got to pick for a certain period of time there. They take a little quick look, 10 minutes, and he was the one, you know, they got to send another black man to tell other black people, hey, get back to work. Garvey had experienced that. But it was because of that trade and because of that position within that trade and his elder and his uncle in specific who gave him that particular trade. And as we're moving forward in this discussion on the history and legacy of Marcus Garvey and what it means to the African nation today, we need to consider that in regards to what we are doing going forward in regards to carrying out his legacy, repatriating to Africa, and coming with skills that will help in development. And so Marcus Garvey came through those years as a young man up through his 20s, observing those things through Panama and Costa Rica and many different places. So by the time he gets ready to establish the UNIA, he is well home in the experience. See, traveling gives you such a great experience because what happens is you get to see how the mechanisms of imperialism work in different ways in different places. Like, oh, they're getting down like this over here. Over here where they got us, we couldn't sugar cane. Down here, they couldn't banana. And it's dangerous as hell. Got spiders and snakes and all this stuff. People get bit. You know, it's horrendous conditions. It's not, you know, we understand how imperialism did with the captive Africans working on these particular tropical plantations because, of course, the native people weren't able to, in many circumstances, stand up under these conditions. And in other circumstances, they could get away fast because they needed to lay the land, right? So Garvey was able to experience all of this and take that very valuable education into the organization. So for the sake of time, I want to just bring us up to 1918 and 1922 when the Garvey movement was being well established. And then we're going to go into some of the things that New Africa, more things outside of that vocational trade viewpoint that New Africa needs to look at as far as Marcus Garvey's legacy, so we can start putting some of these things into practice on a unified level. Ideology, right? There were many reasons for the rapid growth of the UNIA. Marcus's dedication and tireless work certainly helped. His oratorical skill was a big help, too, for people would come from far and wide just to hear him speak. He also had charisma, the power to attract people and hold their loyalty. He could exert tremendous power over an audience. He could stir their emotions and sweep them along with the power of his words. And the mass of people who became his followers were known for their loyalty. Many thought of him as a superhuman being who had been sent to rescue the race from suffering and oppression. The times were also suitable for the spread of Garvey's message, for the period around the end of World War I was one of ferment in many countries. The war had been brought, supposedly, to make the world safe for democracy, and as it neared its end, oppressed people began clamoring for some of that democracy that the politicians had spoken about. The Russian Revolution in 1917 and the Irish Easter Uprising in 1916 against the British were like the formation of UNIA, part of that worldwide ferment. So we're setting the tone of the time to understand that this was a great period of political transition throughout the world, with that great world war having been taking place and us going, us gaining the consciousness and unity to start demanding the liberation that was due an independent people. And so let's talk about the newspaper, because that's very important. And particularly in this time of social media and even what we're doing right here, right? I always call it propaganda, because you, when you present yourself before someone, then you owe it to yourself and the people based on the seriousness of the situation that we're in. We're under a genocidal condition that you speak seriously and you go straight to the point of what it is that it, you're dealing with, like actually. You don't look to entertain yourself. Somebody has to be the one that grabs the political horn and seeks to steer the bulls to a position whereby which we can gain some kind of leverage and control in whatever avenue, right? And so media and these type of things gives us the opportunity, specifically with internet neutrality, if you want to call it that, because we know what happens when we get real serious with this guy, right? And shut that job down, right? But the Negro World, the weekly newspaper, was Marcus's most successful publication. It began in the autumn of 1918 and was published up to 1933. Within a few years, it became the most widely distributed black newspaper in the world. English was his main language, but sections were also printed in Spanish and French. The front page of each issue usually carried a stirring message from Marcus Garvey. UNIA members all over the world read and discussed these messages at their weekly meetings, much the same way that Christians read the gospel at church services on the Sabbath. The British, French, and other colonial rulers in Africa and the West Indies were very fearful of the Negro world. They did not take kindly to Marcus's preachers of race, pride, and anti-colonialism. They therefore banned the newspaper in such places as Trinidad, Honduras, British Guiana, the Gold Coast, Ghana, Zimbabwe, and elsewhere, including all the French African colonies. Even French ones. Seamen usually smuggled the paper in whenever it was banned. Wherever it was banned. Persons found with it in those countries were allowed to be fined or imprisoned. In Zimbabwe in 1927, an African was given life imprisonment for importing a few copies of the Negro World. So the boys in Zimbabwe have been there out there smoking. Like all the time, right? You start to see the occurrences of particularly focused revolutionary energy in certain places over time in history. He was very relieved when protesting Africans took their case all the way to the British Parliament. Marcus told the British that they were wasting their time by trying to suppress the newspaper. Speaking in May 1920, he said, I think the British government made a great mistake when they suppressed the Negro world, because they only opened the eyes of those sleeping West Indian Negroes to the realization that the government was trying to keep some from them, to keep them in darkness about the great progress of Negroes in the outer world, right? So this organ, which, like Garvey said, couldn't be stopped. You know, the boys working on, you're going to work us on the ships, we're going to smoke that Guardian, you know. We're going to, you know what I'm saying, we're going to get in there and drop that off. You know, it's like that dope. You know what I mean? Smuggling that dope. One of the other great projects of the Universal Negro Improvement Association that we need to revisit again is the Black Star Line, right? Hell, that idea will never go out until they find a way to fly you from here to there in 3 seconds, you know? And then with that, how you gonna get all this stuff over there with it? Y'all gonna need ships. You're always gonna need ships, right? So New Africa needs to think about that. One of the most spectacular events of 1919 came in October that year when the Black Star Line Steamship Corporation launched its first ship, the Yarmouth. The Black Star Line was the brainchild of Marcus Garvey and the UNIA. For black people to own a modern shipping company at that point in history seemed like an impossible dream to many. White newspapers flashed the news in disbelief all over the world. Black people rejoiced, for this event seemed to provide a ray of hope for their mostly dreary situation. The Black Star Line was designed to show what self-reliance could do. It was financed with money from its shareholders, all of whom were black, and most of whom were UNIA members. The line also offered an alternative to the racism practiced by white shipping companies. Black passengers were usually segregated in those days. A passenger on the British ship, Maraud, sailing from Trinidad to New York via Grenada, reported that black passengers were only allowed to eat after the whites had finished. On the Black Star Line, passengers would be subjected to no such indignity. It was not easy to find qualified officers in 1919, and the Black Star Line was forced to hire some whites, including captains. Listen to me now. For his first ship, however, Marcus later hired as captain one of the few black men in the world with the necessary master's license. This was Captain Joshua Cockburn, a native of Bahamas, who had sailed in Nigeria, in Nigerian and other African waters for many years. Like one we call Cuffy Chains, right? It was a proud UNIA, which renamed the Yarmouth the Frederick Douglass in honor of the 19th century Afro-American leader. Many thousand Garveyites and UNIA sympathizers turned up at 135th Street dock in Harlem to witness the ship launching on October 31st, 1919. The Frederick Douglass traveled to Cuba, Jamaica, and Panama on his first trip. A second and third trip followed, also to West Indian, Central America, and the United States ports. The Black Star Line acquired a second vessel, the Shadyside, in April 1920. This was an excursion boat that took passengers on summer cruises up and down New York's Hudson River. While anchored for the winter, it sank in a snowstorm. The line's third ship was the Kanawha, which made its maiden voyage in June 1920. The UNIA renamed the ship the Antonio Maceo after the black general of Cuba's struggle for independence. In March 1921, Antonio Maceo sailed from New York to Cuba and Jamaica. On his return voyage, it broke down and was abandoned near Antigua, Cuba. A fourth ship ain't stopping. See, determination. You don't stop. Fail that, they'll get messed up, do it again. And then do it right. A fourth ship was negotiated for, but never obtained. Even though the company paid down over $20,000 on it, the Black Star Line had plans to name the ship after the famous Phyllis Wheatley. Wheatley was born in Africa around 1753, and while Phyllis Wheatley was transported to the United States as a slave. Of course, so you see the history of the determination in regards to establishing that which he knew was very necessary. So we need to think about that with all of the millionaires and all that, and all the private claims and big old house and all that. I don't hear no black people talking about what the black shipping line. Where's that? Talk to me. If it's out there, prove me wrong. I got some stuff I need to get over there. Everywhere that the Black Star Line ships went, they were greeted by scenes of wild enthusiasm. In Havana, Cuba, a Black Star Line vessel was showered with flowers and food. In Boca del Toro, Panama, thousands of workers deserted their jobs for a day to see the Frederick Douglass. They brought gifts of flowers and fruit and danced on the ship's deck. In South Carolina, USA, people chartered a special train to take them to the Port of Charleston when the Black Star Line stopped out. Yes, the Black Star Line, after a spectacular initial success, failed in the end. The persons, both black and white, who took part in negotiations for the ship defrauded the company of tens of thousands of dollars. The white officers also deliberately wrecked the ship's engines, causing thousands of dollars worth of unnecessary repairs. Some of the line's black employees were also dishonest and stole the company's money. That's what happened. We understand that. We know what happened with us, right? So let's go to the political, right? Let's go to the organization. Another thing we need to look at, unified front. By late 1919, Marcus Garvey's name was known throughout the world. The time was now right to begin work on an event. Every bit as spectacular as the launching of the Black Star Line had been, Marcus had been planning for a massive assembly which would bring together representatives of all the world's African peoples. The call went out to UNIA branches and other organizations all over the world to select delegates for this great event, the first international convention of Negro peoples of the world. Marcus's worldwide popularity was now so great that organizations far and wide answered his call. Delegates, some of them very prominent members of their home communities, poured into New York for the convention, which was held from August 1st to 31st, 1920. From Liberia and South Africa, they came from England and Canada, from Trinidad and Panama, and from many other countries. Fully 25,000 black people jammed Madison Square Garden to capacity and overflowed into the surrounding New York streets for the opening ceremony. No convention in Afro-American history has ever been bigger up to the present day. The convention parade stretched 10 miles. The parade stretched 10 miles, and that's with 10 people marching abreast, right? So it's 10 across, 10 miles deep. Martha rode in an open car in a military uniform and plumed hat, similar to the type worn by the leaders of the powerful Masons at that time. The UNIA now has sprouted several auxiliaries, and they added color to the march. There were Universal African Legions, the military outfit on horseback and on foot. The men and women of the African Motor Corps, another military auxiliary, were also on parade. The Black Cross nurses were there in their long white dresses, white stockings, and shoes, and white head ties, bearing a Black Cross. The officers and crew of the Black Star Line were on parade, too, in their naval uniforms. And so were the boys and girls of the UNIA juveniles, the youth arm of the organization. Several brass bands provided music, including the Black Star Line Band. Real party. Real organization. A nation birthing itself with great pomp and circumstance. You know what I'm talking about? We need to look at this and see how he got all of the organizations and representatives from around the world to come, how he kept them secured, where they stayed at the hotel, how they had transportation. That's the work of nationhood, right? So the Black Star Line and the convention, 25,000 people, not only 25,000, it was like they had to let 25,000 people in, and then those people had to leave, then they had to let 25,000 more in. So it was like hundreds of thousands, like actually. Right, more than 25,000. Just that's the capacity that God holds. But speaking of some personal highlights of Elder Garvey, now holding back in on him personally, we're going organizationally back to personally. This is an honor and tribute and lesson in the history of our great comrade ancestor Malcolm Garvey as we look to recreate what it is that he gave us and build on the legacy of it in unity with the present organization, the UNIA, which myself and other organizations, All African People's Revolutionary Party, Friends of the Congo, and others are in coalition with. Shout out to Brother John, President of UNIA, Division 421, Atlanta, and his predecessor in that position as president for years, Rob's mom. Shout out to y'all comrades, Riggs First. Marcus went through four major experiences in his personal life between 1918 and 1922. He was almost killed, got himself married, divorced his wife, and married a second time in 4 years. One day in October 1919, a man walked into the UNIA office and asked to see Marcus God. When Marcus appeared, there was a brief conversation between the strangers before the stranger whipped out a gun and fired four shots. Two of the shots missed Marcus, but one hit him in the head and another got him in the leg. He was rushed to Harlem Hospital where the wounds were happily found to be superficial. The would-be assassin, one George Tyler, was taken to jail but died there under mysterious circumstances. It was widely believed that he had been hired by an influential person or persons to kill Garvey and that he was himself killed before he could tell his story in court. Right? Check it out now. George Tyler, another one of these rat boys. Another old man, Gene Robinson, one of these guys, right? Marcus was married not long after this, on December 25th, 1919, in Liberty Hall, Harlem. Man gets shot and then go get married. Right? His bride was Amy Ashwood, the 17-year-old girl he had met in Jamaica back in 1914. She had gone off to Panama in 1916, but had come to New York late in 1918. From that period on, she began to become very active in the UNIA. Marcus and Amy Ashwood went on a three-week honeymoon to Canada, but the marriage was over in less than 2 months. Marcus accused her of infidelity, dishonesty, and various other things. She made similar accusations against Marcus. Marcus divorced Amy Ashwood in June 1922 while she was away in England. 1 month later, he married another Amy, this time Amy Duff. The two Amys had been best friends from their teenage years in Jamaica, and Amy Duff, wife number two, had actually been chief bridesmaid at Amy Ashwood's wedding. The second marriage lasted until Marcus's death in 1940. It was a successful marriage despite Marcus's very busy schedule. His work left him with less time for family life than most people have. Amy Duff proved the perfect spouse for someone in his position. She began her association with Marcus in 1919 as his private secretary. From that point on, she immersed herself fully in the work of the organization. So Amy Duff, of course, is responsible for much of what we know in regards to the legacy of Marcus Garvey, many of the publications. And the first wife disputed to her death the things that she had been accused of and did not recognize the divorce between her and Garvey. Right. But Amy Duff edited the now famous collection of his articles in, you know, Philosophy and Opinions of Marcus Garvey, Africa for the Africans. In 1927, while Marcus still in jail, she published two books of his poetry. Amy Duff also tried her hand at writing essays and short stories. For a time, she edited the women's page of the UNIA's weekly newspaper, The Negro World. Marcus and Amy Duff had two sons. In Harlem, the Garveys lived comfortably, though modestly, in an apartment not far from the UNIL offices. The furnishings included a large number of books and African objects. Marcus's sister, Indiana, and her husband shared the apartment for a short time. Remember Indiana? All the rest of their siblings died. It was just Marcus and Indiana, so Indiana's still kicking it. She came here, stayed for a while, her husband got their own place, right? So let's examine now, from the Pan-African perspective, the proliferation of the Garvey movement throughout the world and how the scope of it let's just try to get a scope of this work to understand, once again, like I'm saying, what it is that we got to do, you know? Not only do we got to get organized down here in the Southeast United States from Atlanta to Houston to back to up top to New York in the Midwest, Chicago, Cali, we got to go down and cover the Caribbean, you know? We got to get connected on the continent, for sure. That's the root of what it is that we have to do in the perspective of God and his philosophy, because the African and his viewpoint was not going to be respected and have a source of inspiration until Africa was free. Then the rest of the Africans around the world could relate to that politically and then have that sense of independence and that spiritual center to rally around. You see what I'm saying? So Garveyism in the West Indies and Latin America in the 1920s. Cuba, right? Of course. The West Indies is the birthplace of the UNIA. Of course, Marcus Garvey born in Jamaica, first chapter in Jamaica. But, of course, as we know, not as successful until it came to the United States, right? But when it did catch up, of course, Cuba had 52 UNIA chapters in the mid-1920s. 52. In Cuba. That 50 is one of every city, must be. Right? Trinidad and Tobago had at least 30 UNIA branches. Right? That's the best of Williams. Them had a leg to see there, so the people just step right on in them. Right? Jamaica, 11 branches. Nothing catch on there, not strong. That was always a crook, the position with Garvey, the lack of support to a level and degree. It should have been from his home island. But when we go and understand Jamaica and study the classism system there, then we start to understand what was going on with that. British Guyana, 7 branches. Dominican Republic, 6. Barbados, 2. So the Caribbean, British, Honduras, 4 well-organized. United States, Virgin Islands. D. Hamilton Jackson, founder of the St. Croix Labor Union, maintained contact with the UNIA's brother-in-law, Caspar Holstein, was a leader of the Virgin Islands independent movement in New York. Holstein, a wealthy man, also contributed generously to the work of the UNIA in New York City. So, you see these connections, these political connections from the island back up to basically New York. Because as we know, New York was outside of Florida, one of the main immigration points of people from the West Indies into the United States. Old Jamaica, Queens, old places up there named after Jamaica, right? So same thing with the Guyana, you know, same thing with the Dominican, right? Whole community established. So New York being that center of immigration, only being fitting that the establishment of the headquarters of the UNIA would, of course, be in Black Harlem, right? So now let's talk about Garveyism in Africa as we're coming up back into that central focus organizing viewpoint of what it is that has to be done, Pan-Africanism. Right? Africa occupied a central position in Garvey's thought. Of course, we know that. His most important goal was to help bring about the day when Africa would excel as European conquerors united and become a strong and respected member of the world community of nations. Such a strong Africa would then be able to provide support and protection for the African people all over the world. Right? So, there were more UNIA branches in South Africa than anywhere else on the continent. What does that tell you? Right? The most oppressed place on the continent, and get this correct now. You talk about South Africa, you talking about, yeah, I know what Leopold did in the Congo and the French and West Africa and all of that. When you talk about West Africa, I mean Southern South Africa, when you really study it anthropologically, I mean when we were there in Namibia, there was paintings on caves that was a language that nobody could speak, because all of those people, that whole tribe of people down there, they disappeared by the boards, man. So, you know, we understand what apartheid did, but it takes a study, particularly those years after the Zulus moved up to the struggle for political independence in South Africa, where there were mass extinction campaigns. We need to go ahead and dig up this whole place and find our ancestors and bury them properly, right? But Garvey's movement had its most significant stand in South Africa. Where the Klansmen were there, where they watching everything, right? They were still able to smuggle them in. They had more chapters, more organized there, more than any other place on the continent, right? In Cape Town, there were many. New Johannesburg, Goodwood, Pretoria, East London. In addition, Garveyites were in the leadership of the two most powerful African organizations in South Africa, namely the Industrial and Commercial Workers Union and the African National Congress. So, Garvey Cash was in the ANC. Tony just told you. That's Pan-Africanism, right? How do we organize ourselves as a diaspora community of people with all our organizations banding into a united front where we can properly relate to the government, which the ANC runs the government there now, right? How do we properly relate to them? How do we expound upon the legacy of Garvey and African independence and race first from the perspective of the Africans here in the United States who have been oppressed by the greatest military power to have existed in the history of the world? How do we use that historical experience and from an organizational level, fighting against the FBI and the CIA and the local police and the courts and all that? How do we translate that into a history of struggle where our comrades back home can understand and get a leg up on what they're having to deal with the Western imperialism as he rapes and ravages on the continent? How do we make ourselves significant politically as an African community of organizational people in the United States to the whole rest of the African world? That's what Garvey was showing us how to do with these different organs, with the newspaper, with the Black Star Line, with the convention, with the factories, corporation, right? But they was not nearly really individual efforts of people here and there. It was the one organized Negro Factories Corporation. It means everybody factory in there, right? Then we get together on how we advertise our factories together, how we get money together, how we source the origin of goods together to buy more in bulk. These simple things, just that until you think it that way and you look at a good example of it and see then it makes something kick off in your brain and move you towards that type of effort. So continuing to speak about Southern Africa, of course, one of these brothers a few of these figures, right? The president of the ICU from 1924 to 1929 was J.G. Goombs, who was originally from the West Indies, right? Dude that came from the West Indies and went to South Africa. Now he's the president of the trade union, right? Shout out to J.G. Goombs. Right, so several ANC leaders were also great admirers of Malcolm Garvey, and they spread the message of in their newspapers. One such was James Thayil, president of the Cape Western ANC, James Thayil. In South Africa at the time, some African Christians had broken away from white missionaries and had established independent congregations known as Ethiopian churches. Huh? Let me read it again. In South Africa at the time, some African Christians had broken away from white missionaries and had established independent congregations known as Ethiopian churches. Remember the Ethiopian Orthodox Christian Church that was Garvey's joint. Of course, we know Ethiopia is the center of our political and spiritual selves as currently. Some of those adopted Garvey as a prophet who, like Moses, had come to free people from bondage. And his middle name, Messiah, too. The Negro world was not actually banned in South Africa, but its agents were sometimes assaulted and harassed. The local UNIA branch in Basutoland, now the independent nation of Lesotho, was one of the largest in Africa. It reported attendances of 500 to 600 at meetings in 1926. Lesotho was at the time a British colony and was, and still is, completely surrounded by South Africa, of course. There was also UNI branches in Luderitz and Windhoek in Southwest Africa, Namibia. Once it's still in the 1980s, hear UNI a song sung by old people in Namibia. Do you hear me? You can go to Namibia now and they singing that old Garvey, the old Garvey song. And Garvey was a beautiful poet and writer whose writings and songs brought out the spiritual essence of what it felt like to be an African, how it felt to represent a nation under God. Marcus Garvey, the establisher of the order and organization of the modern African nation in the West, as it has to relate to its mother continent. Liberia had a special attraction for Garvey, right? It had been established in 1824, African-American expats who wanted to return. Over the years, they had maintained this special relationship with Africans in the Western world. It was also independent since 1847, and one of the nearest African countries to the United States and the Caribbean. Garvey hoped to move the UNI headquarters and several thousands of his followers to Liberia. His first move was in 1920, when he sent Haitian Ely Garcia as sole commissioner on a mission to Liberia. Garcia met with high government officials and outlined the UNIA's plan. The Liberians gave him every encouragement. He, however, wrote a secret report for Garvey, which criticized some aspects of Liberia. He found the Liberian ruling class to be lazy and incompetent, nor did he like the way the descendants of slaves from the Western Hemisphere lorded over the native-born Africans. He advised that when the UNI get a foothold in the country, it should right those wrongs. This report later found its way into the hands of the Liberian government and it helped turn them away from Garvey. Can't blame the brother though, right? Because we understand the history of Liberia, what he's saying was right. But the neocolonials got a hold to it, so they nicked that. And then we know later on, the deal that was given to Firestone for the land that was supposed to have been given to God. That was the ultimate trick of it all. That was how they, you know, really made him pay all the resources to try to get it established, made him waste all that. And that's what they did to Garvey. Like we were saying earlier, the white captain sabotaged the engine. The officers were fraudulent in their deal, right? Betrayed on every level. But Garvey moved on. In West Africa, in Lagos, the Nigerian capital, contained several hundred UNIA members in 1920. A branch was also started in the northern city of Kano. The Black Star Line had an office in Lagos. Black Star Line, shipping line, got an office in Lagos, Nigeria, waiting for the ship to land, go out there and take the goods off. In 1920. We're 100 years later. So let's go back to, and we know, of course, many of us should have read of the incarceration on the fraud case of Garvey by the federal government of the United States. And the enmity against Garvey, there was a whole Garvey must go movement that a whole lot of black people was in. That's the truth of the history, and we have to look at that and understand that and see why that occurred. What were those reasons? How do we avoid that type of disunity? But the government's case was that Marcus Garvey, as president of the Black Star Line, was responsible for circulars and advertisements claiming that the line was sure to make a profit. The line, of course, eventually folded. The government sought to prove that Marcus knowingly misled shareholders into expecting profits when he knew that there would not be any. So this is, you sabotage my project after I tell my people in earnestness that I know it's going to make money, but But then when you sabotage it and it doesn't, then you turn around and arrest me and say, I lied because I said I knew it wasn't going to make no money, but I told the people it was going to be anyway. That's the most ridiculous notion. It shouldn't even be a conspiracy. That's just straight up shut up, right? So Marcus agreed that companies fail every day and that fact that all promised profit does not make them fraudulent. He tried to show how some of his subordinates had deliberately sabotaged the ships and stolen huge sums of money. Without this thievery and sabotage, the line might have been able to pay dividends. One or two former employees, including Captain Joshua Cockburn, even admitted their dishonest acts. Them folk here, yeah, man, I did it, man. I don't know, man. Them folk paid me to do this, and I did it, you know? And this is the guy who was the one black captain, the most esteemed naval master that was the African that we had. Where else could Garvey turn? Everywhere he turned, everyone was against him, even within the organization, right? So New Africa needs to look at this, right? But I want to give you something before I go. And please stay tuned because you're going to be hearing Marcus continue to speak because we need to study Mark. So stay tuned here and keep on listening as Marcus talks and explains to you what it is that we must become as new Africans, as the African nation in the West and the diaspora, in defense of our motherland, home continent, here in these borders against U.S. imperialism in Babylon. If we do it right, Africans in the United States will be remembered and revered for all history. Forgive me, this double cracker Satan United States government. You hear me? But let me give you something that we don't often think about in regards to Marcus' legacy, right? We know he gave us our flag. We know he gave us that political organization, the convention, the Black Star Line, the Negro World. But let me tell you before, in conclusion, something that he gave us that we might not understand, that once I tell you, you'll understand how important it is to stand upon that legacy. On his arrival back from Atlanta, Marcus had said that he had no intentions of going into local politics. He now changed his mind. Immediately after the convention, he launched his People's Political Party. Check this. The first modern political party in the British West Indies. Marcus gave us everything. He gave us everything. All we have to do is follow through. Study him and follow through. Become united with your brothers and sisters. Build a Black United Front. Deal with those African-centered organizations, right? Not none of that newfangled stuff, that rainbows and all that kind of stuff to deal with. None of that stuff, right? Marcus gave us the first political party in British West Indies. The People's Political Party. Garvey had his eyes on the Legislative Council elections, which were coming up at the end of January 1930. The PPT picked the slate of candidates, with Marcus himself running for the St. Andrew seat. He also prepared for an election manifesto. Among its strengths were the following: self-government for Jamaica and representation in the British Parliament, protection of native labor, a minimum wage, workers' compensation, an 8-hour working day, urban improvement, land reform, and an all-Jamaica water board for irrigation, in other words. Compulsory improvement of urban areas by large companies, which made huge profits in those areas, promotion of local industry, establishment of a university and polytechnic, free secondary and night school education in East Parish, the National Center for Performing Arts, a law to impeach and imprison unjust judges, prison reform, an institution of legal aid, a law against buying or otherwise unfairly obtaining votes at an election, granting Montego Bay and Port Antonio the corporate rights of cities, upgrading the Kingston Racecourse into a national park, and a federation of the West Indies. A federation of the West Indies. It became CARICOM. All of these things I'm naming. from prison reform to impeaching and imprisoning unjust judges. The visionary Malcolm Garvey, he gave us the establishment of from the perspective of the Western diaspora, who we are as a people. He gave us what we needed to become a nation, which is number one, a flag, number two, a government. And those of us that say that we are about true organization and true African liberation need to study these lessons deeply and not just shout out the slogan, and then go into those type of united front works and build a black united front for the liberation of African people under that red, black, and green. I hope you've enjoyed this biographical historical viewpoint on Altiblan News of the great ancestor of Marcus Garvey. As I said, stay tuned as you will hear the great ancestor continue to give us his message of liberation, African unity, and race first. This has been your combat reporter, Brother Tutmo Sankara, here on Altiblan News. And remember, as always, African people, stay vigilant.
To plant the banner of freedom on the great continent of Africa. If Europe is for Europeans, then Africa is for the black peoples of the world. Men and women as black as I am, and even more so, had believed themselves white under West Indian order of society. I was simply an impossible man to use openly the term Negro, yet everyone beneath his breath was calling the black man a nigger. I had to decide whether to please my friends and be one of the black whites of Jamaica and be reasonably prosperous, or come out openly and help improve and protect the integrity of the black millions and suffer. I decided to do the latter. There is no future for a people who deny their past. My forebearers, my grandparents, my mother and father did not suffer and die to give me an education to oppress, slight, or discourage my people. Whatsoever education I acquired out of their sacrifice of over 300 years, I shall use for the salvation of the 400 million Negroes of the world, and the day when I forsake my people, may God Almighty say there shall be no more light for you. I unequivocally rejected the racist assumptions of much white American Christianity, namely that God had created the black man inferior and that he had intended Negroes to be a servant class, hewers of wood and drawers of water. I predicated my view of man and the doctrine of Imago Dei. All men, regardless of color, were created in the image of God. From this premise followed the equality of all men and also the brotherhood of all men. The biblical injunction of Acts 17:26 reminds us that he created of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth. I was most interested in brotherhood within his own race. If Negroes are created in God's image and Negroes are black, then God must in some sense be black. If the white man has the idea of a white God, let him worship his God as he desires. We have found a new ideal. Whilst our God has no color, yet it is human to see everything through one's own spectacles. And since the white people have seen their God through white spectacles, we have only now started out to see our God through our own spectacles. We believe in the God of Ethiopia, the everlasting God, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost, the one God of all ages. That's the God in whom we believe. We shall worship him through the spectacles of Ethiopia. Do you know what it means to be a man? To be a man is to bear resemblance of the Creator, the image of the Creator. If you are conscious of the fact that you are created in the image of the Creator, then you are a man. Man is a religious being, that is to say, he must have some kind of belief, call it superstition or not. Man who has started to think traces his origin beyond man, and such has been groping in the dark to find out the source from whence he came, and by our own intuition, we have attributed that source to something beyond us, and in so believing, we accept the idea of a religion. Some make our God a God of fire, some make our God a God of water, some make our God a God of elements, and others of us accept the Christian belief. Man's religion is something we cannot eliminate from his system or destroy in him. Therefore, it is folly for any man to go about attacking another man's religion, because to him it is fundamental. You may be a Christian, you may be a Mohammedan, that is your religion. We are all entitled to our religious beliefs. Some of us are Catholic, some of us are Presbyterian, some of us are Baptists, and we deem it a right to adhere to our particular belief. The white world has always tried to rob and discredit us of our history. They tell us that Tutankhamun, the king of Egypt, who reigned about the year 1350 BC, was not a black man, that the ancient civilization of Egypt and the pharaohs was not of our race. But that does not make the truth unreal. Every student of history of impartial mind knows that we once ruled the world. When white men were savages and barbarians living in caves, that thousands of Negro professionals at that time taught in the universities of Alexandria, then the seat of learning. No black man shall be truly respected until the race as a whole has emancipated itself to self-achievement and progress from universal prejudice. The black man will have to build his own government, industry, art, science, literature, and culture before the world will stop to consider him. Until then, we are but wards of a superior race and civilization and the outcasts of a standard social system. One of our problems historically is that we have always been reacting to initiatives taken by other people. The fight for African redemption does not mean that we must give up our domestic rights. It does not mean that we must become disloyal to any government or to any country wherein we were born. We can be as loyal American citizens or British subjects as the Irishman or the Jew, and yet fight for the redemption of Africa and complete emancipation of the race. We believe in the United States Constitution for the Americans, but we stand for the idea of Africa for the Africans. It is not our intention, our purpose, to send all black people back to Africa. No. Those of us who go to Africa will become pioneers, pilgrim fathers of the new nation. It is the decision of the black man to make Africa a nation to which we can look for help and support, moral and physical, when ill-treated or abused for being black people. A strong man is strong everywhere. The first black heavyweight boxing champion of the world was Jack Johnson. He was a strong man, and he was strong everywhere he went. He had beaten his white opponents in Australia, he had beaten them in the United States, and he can beat them wherever they presented themselves. The African race could be like Jack Johnson. If it became strong in Africa, then it could be strong everywhere. For 250 years, we have struggled under the burden and rigors of slavery. We were brutalized, we were maimed, we were killed, we were ravaged in every way. We are men, we have souls, we have passions, we have feelings, we have hopes, we have desires like any other race. The cries raised all over the world of Canada for the Canadians, of America for the Americans, of England for the English, of France for the French, of Germany for the Germans. Do you think it unreasonable that we, the blacks of the world, should raise a cry of Africa for the Africans? The Negro is a man. We represent the new Negro. His back is not yet to the wall. We do not want his back to the wall because that would be a peculiar and desperate position. We do not want him there. It is because of this that we are asking for a fair compromise. The Belgians have control of the Belgian Congo, which they cannot use. They have not the resources to develop nor the intelligence. The French have more territory than they can develop. There are certain parts of Africa in which you cannot live at all. Now it is for you to come together and give us a United States of Africa. We are not going to be a race without a country. God never intended it, and we are not going to abuse God's confidence in us as men. We are men, human beings, capable of the same acts as any other race, possessing under fair circumstances the same intelligence as any other race. Africa has been sleeping, not dead, only sleeping. Today, Africa is walking around not only on its feet, but on its brains. You can enslave, as it's done for 300 years, the bodies of men. You can shackle the hands of men. You can shackle the feet of men. You can imprison the bodies of men, but you cannot shackle or imprison the minds of men. Dive down, black men, and dig. Reach up, black men and women, and pull all nature's knowledge to you. Turn you around and make a conquest of everything north and south, east and west, and then when you have wrought well, you will have merited God's blessing, you'll have become God's chosen people, and naturally you'll become leaders of the world. And as you bow down to the white man today, so will other races bow down to you and call you a race of masters because of the superiority of your minds and your achievements. No race has the last word on culture and on civilization. You do not know what a black man is capable of. You do not know what he's thinking. You are thinking in terms of battleships, of dreadnoughts, of submarines, of aeroplanes. Do you know what we are thinking about? That is our own private business. So give us credit for being able to use our minds, and with people becoming conscious of themselves, determined to use their minds, you do not know to what extent they can go. Liberate the minds of men, and ultimately you will liberate the bodies of men. Do you know that the black man is thinking in terms of perpetual motion? He's also thinking in terms of the hidden mysteries of the world, and you do not know what the oppressed and depressed by virtue of his condition and circumstance may give to the world as a surprise. Do you know that when men are forced to do things, they do them with greater effect than when they're not forced to do them? Are you going to force us into a corner where we have to think and think evil? For God's sake, do not force 280 million black men to think evil as to be a menace to the world. Do not force us to think that way. Give us a chance to live in ease as you are living, so that we can bring out those latent hidden powers which made a Newton, give us a Huxley and a Darwin. We are capable of giving such men to the world if forced into a corner to think. We are a peace-loving people. We love humanity. We love the white race, not for social fellowship, but in the common brotherhood that God intended we should live. What satisfaction can anyone get in being happy and see his brother wallowing in dirt, filth, and disease? How can men feel happy living in luxuries when others are living in disease? And then when someone tries to help the other out of the disease, the subtle culprit talks about disloyalty. My greatest desire is to see all humanity happy, whether white, yellow, or black, because I know God made this wonderful world for all mankind. The black men of Carthage, the black men of Ethiopia, the black men of Egypt, of Timbuktu and Alexandria, gave the light of civilization to the world. Ethiopia shall stretch forth her hands unto God, and princes shall come out of Egypt. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you.
The race that leads and others always the race that masters, and the race that is led will always remain a race of slaves. They have given leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. We have decided to find the leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. The great scholars, after passing through our schools, their colleges, their universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. Great Britain under William Pitt, Earl of Chatham did it. America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards, you race of imbeciles, you race of good-for-nothings. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other races have done, what other nations have done, then you had better die. Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it. We have prayed to God for the vision and for leadership, and he himself is now our leader, and he has given us a universal vision, a vision that will not limit our possibilities to America, a vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies, but a vision that says there must be a free and redeemed Africa. If we must solve this American problem, if we must solve the West Indian problem, we shall solve it only for the glory of a great empire. We shall solve it only for the glory of a great dominion, a great republic upon which the sun will never set. Whatsoever man has done, man must do. And methinks, looking into your eyes, I see great warriors rising up in the cause of African freedom. Methinks I see in the eyes of some of you men, a Brutus, reading in his tent at Philippi, a Richard Coeur de Leon bearing down on the galleons of Spain, a Napoleon storming the bridge of Lodi. Yea, men, looking into your eyes, methinks I see a crowned prince storming the forts of Verdun. Yea, more a Marshal Joffrey marching before the French artillery to win at the Marne, everlasting glory for France. And in the eyes of some of you women, I see a Florence Nightingale rising up to do service, not in the Crimean battlefields, but the battlefields of Africa, leading the hundreds and thousands of Black Cross nurses, following the millions of African legions who shall march out to do battle for the everlasting glory of Africa. I see a Joan of Arc, not the white woman of France, but a black woman of Africa, snatch up the flag of the red, the black, and the green, and say to 400 black men, follow me. Shall we make it? By the almighty and the eternal heavens, we have pledged to make it. Give us the standard bearer of Christ. Let him lead, and we will follow. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised, we appeal to you from the great memories of the past. We appeal to you for help, for succor, and for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden up the heights of Calvary, when white men scorned you, when white men spurned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side out of which blood and water gushed forth, it was a black man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took the cross and bore it on the heights of Calvary. So now, when we are climbing our Calvary, the burden being heavy, we ask that you help us on up the journey up the heights. Surely we shall not turn back. The cause is grand, the cause is glorious. Sail on, sail on, O mighty ship of state, sail on, we shall not stop now. We shall sail on until the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hilltops of Africa. Classes, nations, and races which have been quite quiet for over four centuries, and who has been the hewer of wood and drawers of water for other men, who has merely borne abuse, insult, and humiliation for many generations, whose patience, docility, and forbearance can only be compared to the prophet Job, has likewise lifted his bowed head and raised it up to God's skies and cried out, I am a man, and demand a man's chance and a man's treatment in the world. Black people had always been oppressed because of our race. We should therefore strive to put our own racial self-interest first in everything we do. We should support our own businessmen, professionals, writers, athletes, and so on, provided that these persons also have their people's interest at heart. Black people should see beauty in their own kind and not try to bleach their skins or otherwise look like what we're not. In the days of slavery, miscegenation, or race mixture had occurred because the African woman had no protection from the slave master. So there is now no need for black people to themselves freely continue a practice that smacks so much of slavery. Our critics say that the race problem will be solved through higher education, through better education, that black and white will come together. That day will never come until Africa is redeemed. If those who like W.E.B. Du Bois believe that the race problem can be solved in America through higher education, they will work between now and eternity and never see the problem solved. God made man lord of his creation, gave him ownership and possession of the world, and you have been so darned lazy that you have allowed the other fellow to run away with the whole world, and now he's bluffing you and letting you know that the world belongs to him and that you have no part in it. I do not have to apologize to anybody for being black, because God Almighty knew what he was doing when he made me black. If black people knew their glorious past, then they would be more inclined to respect themselves. I shall teach a black man to see beauty in himself and be hanged to the man who said shall not be so. You've heard of Johnny Walker. Well, he had his adversities, and he's still going strong, but I intend, with your assistance and God's grace, to continue. And my work has just begun, and when the history of my suffering is complete, then future generations will have in their hands a guide by which they shall know the sins of the 20th century. I know, and I know you too believe in time, but we shall wait patiently for 200 years, if need be, to face our enemies through our posterity. After my enemies are satisfied, in life or death I shall come back to serve, even as I've served before. In life I shall be the same, in death I shall be a terror to the foes of African liberty. If death has power, then count on me in death to be the real Marcus Garvey I would like to be. If I may come in an earthquake or a cyclone or plague or pestilence or as God would have me, then be assured that I shall never desert you and make your enemies triumph over you. Will I not go to hell a million times for you? If I die in Atlanta, my work shall not only then begin, but I shall live in the physical or the spiritual to see the day of Africa's glory. When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black, and the green around me, for in the new life I shall rise with God's grace and blessing to lead the millions up the heights of triumph with the colors that you well know. Look for me in the whirlwind or a storm. Look for me all around you, for with God's grace I shall come and bring with me countless millions of black slaves who have died in America and the West Indies and the millions in Africa to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. The civilization today has gone drunk and crazy with its power, and by such it seeks through injustice, fraud, and lies to crush the unfortunate. But if I'm apparently crushed by the system of influence and misdirected power, my cause shall rise again to plague the conscience of the corrupt. For this I'm satisfied, and to you I repeat, I'm glad to suffer and even die. Again I say, cheer up, for better days are ahead. I shall rise. The history that will inspire the millions that are coming and leave the posterity of our enemies to reckon with the hosts for the deeds of their fathers. The black race is one of the branches of the human race. As a section of humanity, he occupies a position in a world at the present time most unfavorable and most uncomfortable. The black people are subjects of ostracism. It is sad that our humanity has shown us no more love, no greater sympathy than we are experiencing. Wheresoever you go throughout the world, the black man is discarded, is ostracized, is relegated to the lowest in things, social, economic, and political. This therefore suggests a problem and one that must be solved. We in this section of the world are not entirely free from this unkind, unsympathetic, and uncharitable behavior of the groups or races around us. But since man has been placed on his own responsibility, whether he be black, white, or yellow, he must act on his own account. We will not unduly whine or complain, but reason among ourselves and see what can be done to remedy this state of affairs. I select this subject so I may be able to reach out and touch your hearts and minds, so that we may, with better understanding, go forward and fight properly and surely the battle of life. Life is a conflict. You have to fight your way through it, whether you will it or not. Those who are able to fight most stubbornly live, accomplish most, and to them go the laurels, the palms, and triumph of our civilization and world. We unfortunately have not been trained nor educated to the truth of life, paradoxically so. May I say something? To give you a true knowledge of yourself and life so that the same glory and success attained by other men who understand themselves may be yours. Man in the full knowledge of himself is a superb and supreme creature of creation. When man becomes possessor of the knowledge of himself, he becomes master of his environment, the captain of his own ship, the director of his own destiny, the accomplisher of his own ends. Man should understand himself because man is full of knowledge, and this knowledge is a gift of nature. When Mother Nature created man, she deprived him of nothing. He was given the faculty of understanding all things around him, and this faculty for understanding has not been taken away from man. None of his senses have been taken away from him. So there is no excuse for the black man in lacking the knowledge that man has used to beautify the world and produce all that he needs for his happiness and civilization. Look the world over, and whatever you see in it that is pleasing to man, contributing to man's comfort, to his needs, and to his satisfaction, it is but the work of man. Man blessed with the knowledge of himself and the understanding of all things around him. If you are to live with the knowledge of yourself and with a greater knowledge of nature, you must know what is good and what is not. You must know what is finite. You must know that which is material, physical, or otherwise is at your disposal to create or otherwise use. Yet what have we done in years gone by? There are very few things that we can place to our accomplishment for the past years. At the services of the white race, the bishops of the counties and shires of England will be compelled to discourse upon the grand achievements of the Anglo-Saxon. They will tell you of the flight of the mighty aeroplane R-101 to India, which, although unsuccessful, was a new conquest of the white man in engineering. They will tell you of the conquests in art, industry, in literature. New books have been written, new editions have been made to literature by the Englishman. In the great cathedral of Notre Dame in France, the bishop lecturing to Frenchmen will tell them of the wonderful achievements of the Frenchman. They will tell you that they have crossed the channel with greater speed than they did previously. They will tell you that they have flown from France to England in shorter time than ever before. If we leave the European countries and go to America, whether it be in the Holy Cross Cathedral in Washington or any of the great cathedrals of New York, the bishops are telling of the wonderful works the American geniuses have accomplished. If we leave America and go over to the East, to Japan, they will be telling their fellow citizens of Japan of the wonderful accomplishments of the Japanese people, proving that man is moving onward as time moves on. But you, what can I tell you? I can only point you to yourselves as disorganized. You have shown malice, prejudice, and hate to each other, and the result is that while other races have made progress, while India has made progress towards nationalism, while Ireland has made progress towards republicanism, while the whole world has made progress in man's accomplishments, you still stand fighting yourselves, dishonoring yourselves, showing no disposition towards a higher life so that you will be abundantly best. I do hope that you will so reflect and think that you were created for some purpose other than exhibiting malice towards your neighbor or fellow men of your own race. What a pity it is that we cannot stand united without a written law, as other races do. There is no written law compelling the members of other races to stand together. They are brought together by the gentle touch of nature. The unwritten law of nature caused them to stand together on all occasions. So whether you find them in the field, industrial or political, that one touch of gentle nature causes them to stand together, if need be, die together. But with the black race, you can preach from pulpits, you lecture from the platforms, from the byways and the hedges, the spirit of cooperation, but he will not cooperate. You talk to him gently, you talk to him roughly, and still he will not cooperate. The result is that he falls prey to those who are united without a written law, but by the touch of nature, those who possess an understanding of themselves and walk through the world making you their serfs and slaves. You must acquire an understanding of yourselves. Look around you, see the smiling pictures of nature, the beautiful hedges, the wonderful mountains, the wonderful vegetation all around, the wonderful climate, the beautiful sunset, the salubrious breezes, probably not to be duplicated in any part of the world. But because of your disposition to each other, you live in suffering, in want, in penury, and in debt. You lack the gentle touch of nature, love for each other, you hate yourselves. We in this part of the world constitute 1 millionth part of 400 million, and there are not 10 of us united in the real spirit of racial love. As I have said before, a congregation of white men gathered together as you are, if you were to take a true analysis of their souls, you would find that the heart of every man present beats in unison, carrying out a certain object for the protection of himself and his posterity. But with you it is merely different. That is your disposition. Where are we going to end? I cannot tell. It seems peculiar that we have sprung from the same mold and yet be so different. Our lack of success is traceable to our bad conduct. At the present time, there is great agitation in the country about aliens coming here and monopolizing our trade. How can we blame them when they form such a small part of our population and cannot control themselves? If there is any blame, it is yours because of the lack of cooperation among you. For they could have achieved no success if we didn't want them to. The success we should have, we deny ourselves and give it to them because we hate ourselves. Black men, black women, what is wrong with you? Why have you no affection for yourselves? But I hope to see you living among yourselves as the people I have spoken of, living in charity, love, in sympathy with each other. It can be done. I wonder if you will adapt that course. Isn't it easier to enjoy prosperity than to live in ignorance and darkness? Why select the worst out of nature? Nature never gave pain, suffering, and death to the world. It was man himself who selected death, pain, and sorrow. I wonder if I cannot inspire you to select between good and evil, the enjoyment of which nature is willing to yield. Let me impress upon you once again that whatsoever your hardships may be, whatsoever your difficulties in life, they are all your own selection. And so, if you encourage them, if you husband them and take them to your bosom, they will abide with you. Nature will not take them from you as Mother Nature did not give them to you. She is not responsible for your sorrows. Mother Nature represents all that is beautiful. She gave you the highest personality in the realm divine. Your sorrows are your own. Your neighbor doesn't want to hear them because he didn't give them to you. Black men and women, will you get the knowledge that white men have that causes them to be leaders and masters in the world? They are not gods with a peculiar source of understanding the world around them. They have only given expression to the knowledge of their humanity and been able to use and conquer all to their own satisfaction and glory. And that is why they are always greater than you in every community that you find them. Isn't it strange that wherever the white man is found, he takes precedence over you? Why is that so? Answer that for yourselves, black men and black women. Wheresoever you come in contact with a white man, you always have to go down in defeat before him. Why? Whether it be in England or France or in America, you always have to go down to the white man, and yet he has two eyes, two feet, two hands, same passions, same senses and feelings as you have. Your feet are not put on opposite sides, nor your hands turn the other way around. But it is because you fail to use your will, your knowledge, and your mental faculties to the point where you will enjoy life around you. I am not in the gutters and in the pond of despair because I use my intelligence. But I swear that no man alive shall ever use his intelligence in understanding the works of nature more than I. I shall rise as high as he ascends. I shall meet him on the same platform of mental equality and fight him until thy kingdom come, because nature created us equal. I want you to make up your minds as I have made my mind up many years ago. Make up your minds that you will rise to the knowledge of your soul and extract from Mother Nature the blessings that she will be willing to bestow on her sons. Take from her her sweet drinking water, extract what is pure and reject what is impure. That is what other races do. But you, because of your ignorance, cannot understand and decide between good and evil. With a greater knowledge of life, you are able to appreciate all things around you. I am able to speak to you here because I understand you. Understand your neighbor, your wife, your children, and you will be able to live in harmony with each other and get the best out of life. One man lives in his home pleasantly. He understands his wife, children, his servants. He knows their movements and knows how to interpret them. A second man fails to get along with his family due to the lack of understanding. You will hear a man say, Mr. So-and-so is a nice man to get along with. This is due to the mutual understanding between these two men. As of that citation, so of the laws of nature. So many of you die, so many of you suffer because of your ignorance of the laws of nature. The early Africans were able to be fathers of our civilization because they persevered in their object. When we hear of the civilization of the Alexandrias, of the Timbuktus, the creation of the black man in the early ages, do we realize that the civilization we now enjoy was handed down to the present century, and that the improved civilization that we see is the result of the civilization that the black men laid down thousands of years ago? But the black man went back to sleep and is still sleeping, but we are trying to awaken you to the true consciousness of yourself. You young black men, you young black women, may we not appeal to you, knowing you as we do to turn over a new leaf, rejecting the ignorance, the foolishness, the childishness that has been your part for these many years. We have looked into your faces for these many years, you, the growing mankind, the rising generation, and no serious thought can we see registered on your countenance but the thought of vulgarity. I have been in your presence and my heart bleeds for you, the conduct you reflect. I have listened to your dirty language used to express yourselves when you could have expressed yourselves in good form. Can I appeal to the black manhood to turn over a new leaf? I'm ashamed of my black manhood. What I have said to the black men, I also say to the black women. Your conduct is disgraceful. Young women whose personality spells respectability at the least provocation, the filthy words they utter would always make you run and turn away from them. A race that cannot conduct itself any better than that is bound to go down in defeat, is bound to go down in death, in hell and degradation, while the other race is bound to reach the pinnacle above. Your conduct is going to destroy you. You are driving your best friends away from you. Men will not respect you because you do not respect yourself. As I come in contact with my race, both from a financial and social point of view, I realize how weak we are in the essentials that make for success. You are your own worst enemy. The black man goes into business and tries to do right things, but what do we find? He gets no support from his fellow man. They lie on him, rob him, and the next thing you hear, he's out of business, pulled down by you, his brothers. The other people, by their honesty and faith that they exhibit in each other, are bound to succeed. We, the blacks, have no faith and are dishonest to each other. But I do hope that time will bring a better spirit of cooperation and unity. There is no love for the man in black. See how we are struggling on this earth, struggling as strangers in a foreign clime, struggling in America, in Europe, in Asia, and in Africa, where men look upon us not with love.
Great prophet, teacher, and leader. The date of this modern miracle was August 17, 1887. Garvey was a man who, in retrospect, was far ahead of his time. This is clearly proven by the fact that his ideologies have resurfaced today and could be considered a major factor in the liberation of African peoples the world over. He sought to revive the spirit of black people from despair to hope, from lethargy to positive action, from fear to courage, from inertia to assertiveness, from anti-discrimination dodges to manly confrontation. He gave them goals possible to man, the highest creation of God, because he believed with all his heart in the innate abilities of the African race. On August 1st, 1914, Garvey launched the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League in Jamaica, an organization to advocate the unity and blending of all Negroes into one strong, healthy race. After the First World War, there was a resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan influence in the United States. Another decade of racial hatred and open lawlessness had set in which Negroes were again prominent among the victims. African people were by this time more than ready for a Moses, and only a black man could express the depth of their feelings. Marcus Garvey settled that question for thousands by forming the U.S. branch of the UNIA and ACL in June 1917. On June 10, 1940, at the age of 53, Marcus Mosiah Garvey died in London of a severe stroke without having set foot in Africa. But his impact there was tremendous. He left a rich legacy of history for us to study and utilize in our continued quest for independence and liberation as a people.
The black race is one of the branches of the human race. As a section of humanity, he occupies a position in a world at the present time most unfavorable and most uncomfortable. The black people are subjects of ostracism. It is sad that our humanity has shown us no more love, no greater sympathy than we are experiencing. Wheresoever you go throughout the world, the black man is discarded, is ostracized, is relegated to the lowest in things, social, political, and economical. This therefore suggests a problem and one that must be solved. We in this section of the world are not entirely free from this unkind, unsympathetic, and uncharitable behavior of the groups or races around us. But since man has been placed on his own responsibility, whether he be black, white, or yellow, he must act on his own account. We will not unduly whine or complain, but reason among ourselves and see what can be done to remedy this state of affairs. Life is a conflict. You have to fight your way through it, whether you will it or not. Those of us who are able to fight most stubbornly live, accomplish most, and to them go the laurels, the palms, and triumph of our civilization and world. We unfortunately have not been trained nor educated to the truths of life, paradoxically so. He has shown us no more love, no greater sympathy than we are experiencing. Wheresoever you go throughout the world, the black man is discarded, is ostracized, is relegated to the lowest in things, social, political, and economical. This therefore suggests a problem and one that must be solved. We in this section of the world are not entirely free from this unkind, unsympathetic, and uncharitable behavior of the groups or races around us. But since man has been placed on his own responsibility, whether he be black, white, or yellow, he must act on his own account. We will not unduly whine or complain, but reason among ourselves and see what can be done to remedy this state of affairs. Life is a conflict. You have to fight your way through it, whether you will it or not. Those of us who are able to fight most stubbornly live, accomplish most, and to them go the laurels, the palms, and triumph of our civilization and world. We unfortunately have not been trained nor educated to the truths of life, paradoxically so. May I say something to you to give you a true knowledge of yourself and life, so that the same glory and success attained by other men who understand themselves may be yours. Man in the full knowledge of himself is a superb and supreme creature of creation. When man becomes possessor of the knowledge of himself, he becomes master of his environment, the captain of his own ship, the director of his own destiny, the accomplisher of his own ends. Man should understand himself because man is full of knowledge, and this knowledge is a gift of nature. When Mother Nature created man, she deprived him of nothing. He was given the faculty of understanding all things around him. And this faculty for understanding has not been taken away from him. None of his senses have been taken away from him. So there is no excuse for the black man in lacking the knowledge that man is used to beautify the world and produce all that he needs for his happiness and civilization. Look the world over and whatever you see in it that is pleasing to man, contributing to man's comfort, to his needs and to his satisfaction, it is but the work of man. Man blessed with the knowledge of himself and the understanding of all things around him. If you are able to live with the knowledge of yourself and with the greater knowledge of nature, you must know what is good and what is not. You must know what is finite. You must know that which is material, physical, and otherwise is at your disposal to create or otherwise use. If we leave America and go over to the east to Japan, they will be telling their fellow citizens of Japan of the wonderful accomplishments of the Japanese people, proving that man is moving onward as time moves on. But you have hated yourselves as you have done in previous years. You have shown malice, prejudice, and hate to each other. And the result is that while other races have made progress, while India has made progress towards nationalism, while Ireland has made progress towards republicanism, while the whole world has made progress in man's accomplishments, you still stand fighting yourselves, dishonoring yourselves, showing no disposition toward that higher life so that you will be abundantly blessed. So reflect and think that you were created for some purpose other than exhibiting malice toward your neighbor or fellow men of your own race. What a pity it is that we cannot stand united without a written law. There is no written law compelling other races to stand together. They are brought together by the gentle touch of nature. The unwritten law of nature causes them to stand together on all occasions. So wheresoever you find them in the field, that one gentle touch of nature causes them to stand together, if need be, die together. But with the black man, you can preach to him from the pulpits. You lecture from the platforms, from the byways and the hedges. The spirit of cooperation, but he will not cooperate. You talk to him gently, you try talking harshly to him, he still will not cooperate. The result is that he falls prey to those who understand themselves and walk through the world making you their serfs and slaves. You must acquire an understanding of yourselves. Look around you. See the smiling pictures of nature, the beautiful hedges, the wonderful mountains, the wonderful vegetation all around. But because of your disposition to each other, you live in suffering, in want, in penury, and in debt. You lack the gentle touch of nature, love for each other. You hate yourselves. Black men, what is wrong with you? Why have you no affection for yourselves? Could I hope to see you living among yourselves as the people I've spoken of? Living in charity, love, and in sympathy with each other? It can be done. I wonder if you will adapt that course. Isn't it easier to enjoy prosperity than to live in ignorance and darkness? Why select the worst out of nature? Nature never gave pain, suffering, and death to the world. It was man himself who selected death, pain, and sorrow. I wonder if I cannot inspire you to select between good and evil. Let me impress upon you once again that whatsoever your hardships may be, whatsoever your difficulties in life, they are your own selection. And so if you encourage them, if you husband them and take them to your bosom, they will abide with you. Nature will not take them away from you as Mother Nature did not give them to you. She is not responsible for your sorrows. Mother Nature represents all that is beautiful. She gave you the highest personality in the realm divine. Your sorrows are your own. If you want joy, if you want sunshine, it is before you abundantly in nature. I made a selection of sunshine, the beautiful sunshine. I made a selection to laugh with the moon, to laugh with the stars, and sing with the birds of the forest and of the wilderness, to join in the rhythmic music of the winds that sing from east to west and from north to south. Had I selected sorrow, I would have been dead a long time ago and been without that which would send me into the presence of the divine, because I would have lived not with the knowledge that is divine. We must acquire the higher knowledge of life. Black men and black women, will you get the knowledge that the white man has that causes him to be leaders and masters in the world? They are not gods with a peculiar source for understanding the world around them. They have only given expression to the knowledge of their humanity and been able to use and conquer all to their satisfaction and glory. And that is why they are always greater than you in every community that you find them. Isn't it strange that wheresoever the white man is found, he takes precedence over you? Why is that so? Answer that for yourselves, black men and black women. Wheresoever you come in contact with the white man, you always have to go down in defeat before him. Whether it be in England, in France, or in America, you always have to go down to the white man, and yet he has two eyes, two feet, two hands, same passions, same senses and feelings as you have. Your feet are not put on opposite sides, now your hands turned around the other way. But it's because you fail to use your will, your knowledge, and your mental faculties to the point where you will enjoy life around you. I'm only here and not in the gutters and in the pond of despair because I use my intelligence. And I swear that no man alive shall ever use his intelligence in understanding the works of nature more than I. I shall rise as high as he ascends. I shall meet him on the same platform of mental equality and fight him till thy kingdom come, because nature created us equal. I want you to make up your minds as I've made up my mind years ago. Make up your mind that you will rise to the knowledge of your soul. Because of your ignorance, you cannot understand and decide between good and evil. You don't know whether you're doing right or wrong. With a greater knowledge of life, you're able to appreciate all things around you. I'm able to gather you here because I understand you. Understand your neighbor, your wife, your children, and you will be able to live in harmony with each other and get the best out of life. The early Africans were able to be the fathers of our civilization because they persevered in their object. When we hear the civilization of the Alexandrias, of the Timbuktus, the creation of the black man in the early ages, do we realize that the civilization we now enjoy was handed down to the present century? But the black man went back to sleep and is still sleeping. We are trying to awaken you to the true consciousness of yourselves. You young black men, you young black women, may we not appeal to you knowing you as we do to turn over a new leaf, rejecting the ignorance, the foolishness, the childishness that has been your part for these many years. We have looked into your faces, you growing manhood, the rising generation, and no serious thought can we see registered on your countenance but the thought of vulgarity. I've been in your presence and my heart bleeds for you, the conduct you reflect. I've listened to your dirty language used to express yourselves when you could have expressed yourselves in good form. Can I appeal to the black manhood to turn over a new leaf? I'm ashamed of my black manhood, and what I've said to the black man, I also said to the black women. Your conduct is disgraceful. Young women whose personality spells respectability, at the least provocation, the filthy words they utter would almost make you turn and run away from them. A race that cannot conduct itself any better than that is bound to go down in defeat, is bound to go down in death, in hell, and in degradation. Your conduct is going to destroy you. You're driving your best friends away from you. Men will not respect you because you do not respect yourself. As I come in contact with my race from both a financial and social point of view, I realize how weak we are in the essentials that make for success. You are your worst enemy. The black man goes into business and tries to do the right thing. But what do we find? He gets no support from his fellow man. They lie on him. They rob him. And the next thing you hear, he's out of business, pulled down by you, his brothers. Have no faith and are dishonest to each other. There is no love for the man in black. See how we are struggling as strangers in a foreign clime. Struggling in America, in Europe, in Asia, and in Africa, where men look upon us, not with love.
The government of the United States, along with the Federal Bureau of Investigations Director J. Edgar Hoover, accused Marcus Garvey of using the U.S. mail to trial.
After 11 hours of deliberation, the jury was called in by the eminent Jewish jurist Judge Mack and given a second set of instructions without their request. The gist of it was that if they had come back with a not guilty or hung jury, to remember the expense in which the government would be put, the public would have lost time, the court, the jury, and the witnesses would have to go through the entire exercise again. They went back into the jury room and 30 minutes later came back with a verdict. Justice is greater than the law. If justice was not included in the law, then the law would be of no use to us as human beings. What I was concerned with was the truth. I asked no mercy. I asked no sympathy. I asked for justice based on the evidence given in the courtroom. I later found out that the judge wanted to speed things up because he had an appointment with the International Zionist Convention in Chicago. It was also due to the fact that I had acquired my first set of papers for naturalization. In my closing statement, I told those 12 men that they were to judge a man by the testimony, by what had been brought into the case, by their judgment of what is wrong and what is right. You may condemn the body, but not the soul. It was not in their power to condemn the body. God condemns the soul. Judge me, and God will judge you for judging Marcus Garvey. The trial took 5.5 weeks, and every day I had a fight with the district attorney. As we went along, I realized it was impossible for me to escape the traps that were being laid out by the press, rival organizations, personal enemies, foreign governments who were interested in me being convicted. No one, not even the absent attorney, could have fought for me as I fought for myself, because he would have been risking the friendship and goodwill of the powerful influences that were aligned against me. There were several witnesses brought in by the government who probably, because of a bribe, would say anything the prosecutors told them to. For instance, Edgar Gray, a man with a superabundance of intelligence, could not say where he was really from. He claimed he was born in Sierra Leone, West Africa. That man is a coconut born in Antigua. Superabundance of intelligence. Could not say where he was really from. He claimed he was born in Sierra Leone, West Africa. That man is a coconut born in Antigua. Gray disappeared from the UNIA with funds of the organization, which he handled in my absence and for whom a warrant was out for his arrest. there was also Leo Healy. I regarded him as a friend. The very morning when he came in to testify, I met him outside, shook his hand, not knowing that he was there to testify against me. And he said I was a good man, then I was bad because I did not pay him the bills of the Black Star Line. Gabby was not the Black Star Line. We were not asking his opinion of the Star Line. We were asking his opinion of Marcus Garvey. He said, understand that he believed that I was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Now he knows there ain't no black man a member of the KKK. Well, when we placed Mrs. Lawson on the witness stand, well, she wore dark glasses, obviously, to obscure the movements of her eyes and her line of stare as she tried to communicate with the prosecutor. During cross-examination, we asked her to show her subpoena. She fumbled around and looked at the district attorney, lowering her head, waiting for his approval. She said she bought stock in 1917, even though the Black Star Line never sold stock in 1917. It was not in existence then. She claimed to be sick, as were two other witnesses who were able to make a quick $30 in the 5 minutes they spent on the stand. Prosecutor wanted to appeal to the sympathy of that jury. A young man named Cargill admitted on the stand to the dismay and disgust of the prosecutor that he was told what to say concerning the circulars and letters supposedly brought in as evidence in the case. Folks try to misrepresent me and say that I do not like white people. Some of my best friends are white. The bishop, who was my friend since my youthful days, testified. When I asked him of his opinion of Marcus Garvey, he said, doubtful. They didn't understand what he meant. I was a public man. Opinions differ. Surely some men are doubtful of me and some are not. He didn't say that Garvey was doubtful. When I asked him for his personal opinion, the question was objected to and sustained by the judge, claiming that it was an improper question. There were some white-controlled newspapers who felt that I was railroaded. I remember one of them stated that my troubles began when I stepped on the toes of France and Great Britain, and that it was a very grave question whether justice had been in my case. After I was found guilty, they released me on $25,000 bail pending the hearing of the appeal. While waiting, I formed the Black Cross Navigation and Trading Company, Business Enterprises, which comprised the Negro Factories Corporation, the Black Eagles Flying Corps, dress and millinery shops, a publishing company and printing plant, a phonograph company, a restaurant, laundries, a black doll factory, a hotel, a chain of grocery stores, and the Royal African Motor Corps, a fleet of moving vans. I was in Detroit when the mandate was handed down. Having received a telegram to return immediately, I got on the first train leaving for New York. When I arrived, I was brutally seized by heavily armed men and pulled from a Pullman car at 125th Street Station and taken to the Tombs Prison. Put it, there are certain people who do not like me because I am black. They do not like me because I was not born in the United States. Some Irish slave master gave my great-great-grandfather's name. Garvey is not an African name. It's Irish. Garcia is not African, nor is Thompson or Johnston. They were inherited from our slave masters, English, French, Irish, or Scotch. If I was born in Jamaica, it was no fault of mine. It was because the slave ship which took me to Jamaica did not go to American ports, and that is how some Negroes in America were not born in the West Indies.
Mr. Garvey, why would you want to stand up to a great republic like America?
We're not fighting America. We're not fighting this great government.
Then what are you doing?
We're fighting hypocrisy and lies, and this we're going to fight until the bitter end.
Fearful of being deported?
There's no federal law whereby I could be processed against on the grounds of being an undesirable from the point of view of deportation.
Yes, there is. Under Section 19 of the Act to regulate the immigration of aliens to and their residence in the U.S.
I arrived in this country on March 23rd, 1916. Today is June 18th, 1923. That law still has not been enacted.
From the NAACP says, and I quote, Garvey must go.
Which is why J. Edgar Hoover has trumped up these charges against me.
Do you think it was a good idea to fire your attorney?
Yes.
Do you think that representing yourself could backfire on you?
No, I do not.
Why not?
The Constitution allows every man the privilege to defend himself, to prove his innocence before an American court of justice, and so I decided to do so irrespective of being a lawyer.
District Attorney Matsuk asked the jury, quote, gentlemen, will you let the tiger loose? What's your reaction?
Guilty men are afraid of jail. I'm as much at home in jail for the cause of human rights as I am in my drawing room.
Well, what did you think of Mr. Dancy's testimony?
Mr. Dancy was used by this government to testify against me. You heard him when the prosecutor asked him whether any of the letters were from the Black Star Line.
He couldn't remember.
He couldn't remember. Mr. Dancy can't read. My life is at stake and he couldn't remember. What happened in that courtroom was a charade. You all know he was just lying through his teeth.
For a foreigner, why are you making all these waves? Even George Harris, editor of the New York News, a colored newspaper published in Harlem, referred to you as an alien.
An alien is one who enters a country on his own account without any invitation and who domiciles himself in that portion of the country because of his own desire.
Isn't that exactly what you do?
But against my will, by stubborn protest, somebody seized me and brought me here for my silent repose in Africa 300 years ago.
When they get rid of you, then what?
This is only the first, Marcus Garvey. There will be other cops in the fold.
You met with Edward Young Clark, the acting imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan?
Yes.
What was that meeting like?
It was rather cordial. He made it clear that they are interpreting the true spirit of every true American.
What is the attitude of the Klan towards a Negro who desires to be, say, President of the United States?
That he shall never be as long as there is one white man living in this country.
But isn't America a white man's country?
Yes, it is a white man's country because he conquered the Indian, exterminated him, and took possession of his property. I say the KKK is the invisible government of the United States.
What do you mean?
The Klan represents the spiritual feeling and even the physical attitude of every white man in this land.
Do you realize that such statements could get you lynched?
We have 5 million substantial oak trees between Africa and the West Indies. We are ready for a lynching party tonight if they wanted to.
Recently, there have been several rapings of black women by whites. Was that discussed?
Yes, it was. He claims that they are as much against that as any self-respecting Negro should be. But I know better. In my opinion, they are structured for the purpose of offending, suppressing, and killing Negroes. I would advise every Negro and those who aspire to leadership to form an organization similar to that of the Ku Klux Klan so that they may be able to look out for their own interests and not continue to be begging white people to do for them what they ought to be doing for themselves. Thank you very much. Part of my trial is that I was indicted along with others for conspiracy to use the United States mails to defraud in promotion of the Black Star Line Steamship Company. Yet my conviction was void of conspiracy in that I alone was convicted. If I understand my conviction clearly, I was convicted for selling stock in the Black Star Line after I knew to be insolvent. The difference between us and the trial court is that they wanted a conviction. All the others who had more to do with the actual selling of stock than I went free because they were not wanted. I received the fullest penalty that the law could impose. 5 years in the penitentiary, the maximum fine of $5,000 as provided by the law, and the entire cost of the case, a condition not generally imposed maybe once in 25 years. It was not Marcus Garvey on trial. It was not a question of money on trial. It was the principle of a race fighting for liberty on trial. And when you attack the principles of the UNIA, Garvey goes to war, and he remains on the firing line until he passes away or until victor perches on the banner. I am going to prison because I dare to serve you, neglect my home, a loyal and dear woman, my wife, and myself. Above all the things I prize most in the world is the honor of my name. I have never in all my life, to my conscious knowledge, done one mean act. Because it has always been the policy of my life to live with honor or die for the principle. How well I have succeeded is made manifest in the sweeping consciousness that has taken hold of the race in Africa, America, the West Indies, Central and South America, Asia, and my imprisonment for so doing. The National Association for the Advancement of of Colored People, and others who have combined to fight the UNIA are going to be disappointed. But they cannot harm Marcus Garvey. Not Judge Mack, not J. Edgar Hoover, not W.E.B. Du Bois and his Blue Vein Society, nobody. The history of the movement is now being written. Do you know what history means? History is the guidepost of a race. It is the inspiration for succeeding generations either to go forward or stand still, either to revenge or be revenged. I had a motive and a purpose. It was a crying voice from the grave that said, Garvey, we have suffered for 250 years for your day and time. We expect something of you at this hour. The prejudice against us as an African people is not because of color, it's because of our condition. we must... The prejudice against us as an African people is not because of color. It's because of our condition. If we must have justice, we must be strong. If we must be strong, we must come together. If we must come together, we can only do so through the system of organization. But the fight for African redemption does not mean that you must be disloyal to any government or country wherein you are born. It is not our purpose or intention to send all black people back to Africa. No! Those of us who leave America to go settle permanently in Africa will become pioneers, pilgrim fathers of the new nation. The African race became strong in Africa. It could be strong everywhere. For 250 years, we have struggled under the burden and rigors of slavery. We were brutalized, we were maimed, we were killed, we were rabid in every way. We are men. We have hopes, we have passions, we have feelings, we have desires just like any other race. The cries raised all over the world of Canada for the Canadians, of America for the Americans, of England for the English, of France for the French, of Germany for the Germans. Do you think it unreasonable that we, the blacks of the world, should raise a cry of Africa for the Africans? The Negro is a man. We represent the new Negro. His back is not yet against the wall. We do not want his back against the wall because that would be a peculiar and desperate position. We do not want him there. It's because of this that we are asking for a fair compromise. The Belgians have control of the Belgian Congo, which they cannot use. They have not the resources to develop nor the intelligence. The French have more territory than they can develop. There are certain parts of Africa in which you cannot live at all. So it is for you to come together and give us a United States of Africa. We are not going to be a race without a country. God never intended it, and we are not going to abuse God's confidence in us as men. We are men, human beings, capable of the same acts as any other race, possessing under fair circumstances the same intelligence as any other race. Africa's been sleeping, not dead, only sleeping. Today Africa is walking around not only on her feet, but on her brains. You can enslave, as was done for 300 years, the bodies of men. You can shackle the hands of men. You can shackle the feet of men. Bodies of men, but you cannot shackle or imprison the minds of men. Dive down, black men, and dig. Reach up, black men and women, and pull all nature's knowledge to you. Turn you around and make a conquest of everything, north and south, east and west. And then when you will have wrought will, you will have merited God's blessings. And as you bow down to the white man today, so will other races bow down to you and call your race a masters because of the superiority of your minds and your achievements. We must canonize our own saints. Create our own martyrs and elevate the positions of fame and honor. Black men and black women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history. Sojourner Truth is worthy of a place of sainthood alongside of Joan of Arc. Christopher Alex and George William Garden are entitled to the halo of martyrdom with no less glory than that of the martyrs of any other race. Africa's produced countless numbers of men and women in war and peace whose luster and bravery outshine that of any other people. Then why not see good and perfection in ourselves? God made man lord of his creation, gave him possession and ownership of the world. And you have been so darned lazy that they have allowed the other fellow to run away with the whole world, and now he's bluffing you and telling you that the world belongs to him and that you have no part in it. I don't have to apologize to anybody for being black, because God Almighty knew exactly what he was doing when he made me black. You race of cowards, you race of imbeciles, you race of good-for-nothings. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other races have done, what other nations have done, then you, I, can we do it? We can do it. If any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Let me say that again. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. They gave leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. But we decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. Britain under William Pitt, Earl of Chatham did it. America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. Because when the history of my suffering is complete, future generations shall have in their hands the guide by which they shall know the sins of the 20th century. I know, and I know you two believe in time, but we shall wait patiently for 200 years if need be to face our enemies through our posterity. After my enemies are satisfied, in life or death I shall come back to serve even as I served before. In life I shall be the same, in death I shall be a terror to the foes of African liberty. Than me to be the real Marcus Garvey I would like to be. If I may come in an earthquake or a cyclone or a plague or pestilence or as God would have me, then be assured that I shall never desert you and make your enemies triumph over you. If I shall die in prison in Atlanta, my work shall not only just begin, but I shall live in the physical or the spiritual to see the day of Africa's glory. When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black, and the green around me. For in the new life, I shall rise up with God's grace and blessings to lead the millions up the heights of triumph in the colors that you well know. Look for me in the world when there are storms. Look for me all around you. For I shall come back and bring with me countless millions of black slaves who have died in America, who have died in the West Indies, and millions who have died in Africa to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. The world today has gone drunk and crazy with its power. And by such true injustice, fraud, and lies have crushed the unfortunate. But if I'm crushed by the system of influence and misdirected power, my cause shall rise again to plague the conscience of the corrupt. For this I'm happy to suffer and even die. But I will write the history for the millions that are coming and leave the posterity to reckon with the host for the deeds of their fathers. If others laugh at you, return the laughter to them. If they mimic you, return the compliment with equal force. They have no more right to dishonor, disrespect, and disregard your feeling in manhood than you have in dealing with them. Honor them when they honor you. Disrespect and disregard them when they vilely treat you. Their arrogance is but skin deep, an assumption that has no foundation in morals or in law. They have sprung from the same family tree of obscurity as we have. Their history is rooted in as primitiveness as ours. Their ancestors ran wild and naked, lived in caves and in branches of trees like monkeys as ours. They made human sacrifices, ate the flesh of their own dead and the raw meat of wild beasts for centuries, even as they have accused us of doing. Their cannibalism was more prolonged than ours. When we were embracing the arts and sciences on the banks of the Nile, their ancestors were still drinking human blood and eating out of the skulls of their conquered dead. When our civilization had reached the noonday of progress, they were still running naked and sleeping in holes and caves with bats, rats, and other insects and animals. After we had already unfathomed the mystery of the stars and reduced the heavenly constellation to minute and regular calculus, they were still backwoodsmen living in ignorance and in blatant darkness. The world today is indebted to us for the benefits of civilization. They stole our arts and sciences from Africa. Then why should we be ashamed of ourselves? Remember always that the Jew in his political and economic urges are always first a Jew. The white man is first a white man under all circumstances, so you can do no less than be black by black, and then all else will take care of itself. No one inoculate you with evil doctrines to suit their own conveniences. There is no humanity before that which starts with yourself. Charity begins at home. So first that thyself be true, and thou canst not then be false to any man. Being at present scientifically the weaker race, in your homes and everywhere possible, you must teach the higher development of science to your children, and be sure to develop a race of scientists par excellence. For in science and religion lies our only hope to withstand the evil designs of modern materialism. At the great Church of Rome, black people the world over must practice one faith, and that of confidence in themselves, with one God, one aim, one destiny. Never forget your God. Remember, we live, work, and pray for the establishing of a great and binding racial hierarchy, the founding of a racial empire whose only natural, spiritual, and political limits shall be God and Africa at home and abroad. Because we are descendants of a suffering people. We are the descendants of a people determined to suffer no longer. Many men and women as black as I am, and even more so, had believed themselves white under the West Indian Arab society. I was simply an impossible man to use openly the term Negro, yet everyone beneath his breath was calling the black man a nigger. I had to decide whether to please my friends and be one of the black whites of Jamaica and be reasonably prosperous, or come out openly and help improve and protect the integrity of the black millions and suffer. I decided to do the latter. There is no future for people who deny their past. My foreparents, my grandparents, my mother, my father did not suffer and die to give me an education to slight, oppress, or discourage my people. Whatsoever education I acquired out of their sacrifice of over 300 years, I shall use for the salvation of the 400 million black people of the world. And the day when I forsake my people, may God Almighty say, there shall be no more light for you. I unequivocally rejected the racist assumption of much white American Christianity, namely that God had created the black man inferior, that he had intended Negroes to be a servant class, you as a wooden draws of water. I predicated my view of man in the doctrine of Imago Dei. All men, regardless of color, were created in the image of God. From this premise followed equality of all men and the brotherhood of all men. The biblical injunction of Acts 17:26 reminds us that he created of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth. I was most interested in brotherhood within his own race, because if Negroes are created in God's image and Negroes are black, then God must, in some sense, be black. If the white man has the idea of a white God, let him worship his God as he desires. We have found a new ideal. Because whilst our God has no color, and yet it is human to see everything through one's own spectacles, and since the white people have seen their God through their white spectacles, we have only now started to see our God through our own spectacles. We believe in the God of Ethiopia, the everlasting God, and we shall worship him through the spectacles of Ethiopia. Do you know what it is to be a man? To be a man is to bear resemblance of the Creator, the image of the Creator. If you are conscious of the fact that you are created in the image of the Creator, then you are a man. Man is a religious being. That is to say, you must have some kind of belief, call it superstition or not. Some of us make our God a God of fire. Some of us make our God a God of water. Some of us make our God a God of elements. And others of us accept the Christian belief. Religion is something we cannot eliminate from his system or destroy in him. Therefore, it is folly for any man to go about attacking another man's religion, because to him it is fundamental. Be a Mohammedan, that is your religion. We are entitled to our own religious beliefs. Some of us are Catholic, some of us are Baptist, some of us are Presbyterians, and we deem it a right to adhere to our own particular belief. The white world is always trying to rob and discredit us of our history. They tell us that Tutankhamun, the king of Egypt, who reigned about the year 1350 BC, was not a black man. That the ancient civilization of Egypt and the pharaohs was not of our race. But that does not make the truth unreal. History of impartial mind knows that we once ruled the world. When white men were savages and barbarians living in caves, thousands of our professionals at that time taught in the universities of Alexandria, then the seat of learning. Ethiopia shall stretch forth our hands unto God, and princes shall come out of Egypt. No black man shall be truly respected until the race as a whole has emancipated itself through self-achievement and progress from universal prejudice. He has to build his own government, industry, art, science, literature, and culture before the world will stop to consider him. Until then, we are but wards of a superior race and civilization and the outcasts of a standard social system. Back in the days of slavery, race mixture and miscegenation had occurred because the African woman had no protection from the slave master. So there is no need today for black people to themselves freely continue a practice that smacks so much of slavery. One of our problems historically is that we have always been reacting to initiatives taken by other people. You cannot depend upon another race to free you. That is a basic law of human existence. I came into the Caucasian culture at a time when the white man still had a need for the black man's labor. I preached and penetrated the mass black man's consciousness to such a degree that the white man felt threatened by me being capable of commanding so much black time and attention. Whites find it hard to sit idly by and let this black man take their slave labor away, especially back to Africa. Who then would bear the white man's burden? I feel that my blood shall pay that remission for which future generations of our race shall be declared free. Freedom of action, freedom of opportunity are things we need, which I believe can only be gained after we shall have established an imperial power to command the respect of other races and nations. Vile thoughts bring vile actions to vile people living in vile times. You could not tell me in the 1920s that 80 years later the world would be infested with neutron bombs, AIDS, drugs, homelessness, terrorism,
laser beams and visible nuclear devastation. However, were I alive today, I would still recommend the same remedy for my people's upliftment. Self-esteem, self-respect, and self-reliance in a world gone crazy with individualism. I never taught racism, but rather dignity and pride in one's race. With God's dearest blessings, I leave you for a while. One love.
Ah, yes. And Ancestor Garvey, if you, the fact that his middle name is Mosiah and that his words are so prophetic lets you know that he was meant to exist before he was born. That Mosiah, that leader, that progenitor of the independence of the African populations in the West, Marcus Garvey, that organizer, that strength is the inspiration for what it is that we have to do. And the example, those words, you listen to the conscious identification of the same things that we're dealing with now as activists, betrayal within organizations, lack of participation by the wider community, government infiltration, same things, right? And the thing that you have to understand about Marcus Garvey and the reason why we have to keep that as a lesson and example is because he set the standards for what it was that the United States government knew that it had to stop as a mass organizational effort. And that all that has come after that, a couple of weeks ago, I showed you the other book, Marcus Garvey and the Vision of Africa, where it spoke about in there that Elijah Muhammad had been an officer in the Universal Guard. Daddy Grace, Father Divine, Malcolm X's father, Reverend Little. All of these, Nation of Islam, Black Panther Party, New Black Panther Party, WADU, ASCAP, the foundation of organizational activity, in particularly in the United States and the West Indies, is centered around Garvey. So we must take those examples and those lessons and study that which has been left to us by the eminent scholar, Brother Tony Martin, as I showed you before, and those 9 volumes in this series, the new Marcus Garvey Library. Check Ancestor Tony Hill. Study the lessons of Garvey. Create those Black United Fronts and race first forward to African Revolution. Once again, this has been your combat reporter, Brother Tutmosis McCarver, here on Al Chimalan News. And remember, as always, African people, stay busy.